Welcome to the Gardening Network. This is Siobhan Shaw, one of your most amazing hosts. and I'm with Lisa Miller-Robert.
Woo! Hi, everybody.
Oh, we've got a little bit of feedback here. Hang on, let's just see how we have feedback. Has somebody got their... Nope, no feedback. Sorry, we'll start again. we are going to be talking about canning and preserving today. Our guest is Lynn Deerdorf. She's a professional canner and food preservationist from Atlanta, Georgia. And this show is brought to you by LittleCropCircles.com. We're launching September 8th on Indiegogo, so go check them out. Find out how you can grow more in small spaces. And Lisa Sellers-Robert is our in-house horticulturalist. She's the expert on all things gardening. How are you doing today?
Howdy, fine. Thank you. So good to join you today. Yes, it's going to be fun.
So it's all about canning and preserving, and you wrote to me on Facebook and said, who's doing the introduction today? I said, I can. It's a little inside gardening, canning joke.
That's
and
right.
Our guest is a professional canner and food preservationist, Lynn Deerdorf. Hello, Lynn. Welcome to the Gardening Network.
Hello. Thank you. I'm looking forward to talking about my favorite subject.
Woohoo! So let's start off, because you live in Georgia, and around the world, they're known for their peaches.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And they've been coming into season for, four or five weeks already. So we've been doing a lot of good canning. In fact, yesterday, I'm sorry, getting my days mixed up. On Saturday, I just taught a class that, among other things, we did spiced peach butter. And that is on my website. And if anybody is interested in doing it, it is amazing. It's like biting into a fresh peach. Oh, so good stuff right now. This is the height of the canning season, isn't it?
It is. And Lynn's recipe can be found at preservingnow.com. So make sure you go there, preservingnow.com. So, Lynn, why should we be canning?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. A lot of people have the idea that canning is a very laborious thing, and I'm sure they know that from things that our grandmothers and our ancestors did, because it was a matter of survival.
That's right.
It isn't so much, of course, a matter of survival these days, although maybe people who are on farms want to make sure that they catch their crops, their big crops, and sell well. Beyond that, in our modern times, there are several reasons why people, and there's a burgeoning interest in it right now. Here's a couple of reasons why. First of all, I think that my mom and maybe your mom and grandmother got into the supermarkets when in its heyday with a lot of convenience foods, and we got away from a lot of the learning and understanding about home canned food and tasting what it tastes like. If you've had it, you know how wonderful it is, because you're canning at the peak of freshness, and oftentimes it's in that jar within 24 hours. And so that's the best taste you can possibly get. So we've kind of lost a sense of taste on a lot of the things that we're buying at the grocery stores. And once you've tasted this or you remember this, you kind of want to go back to it. Another reason is that a lot of us are really concerned about health and diets. Yeah. And we know that our processed foods, whether it's meat or dairy or canned foods or packaged foods of any kind, have a lot of things added to it. Mm-hmm. Those things you can't pronounce with long names, a lot of chemicals, many of which are preservatives, their food colorings, their artificial flavors, artificial colors, as I mentioned, but a lot of these things that we're getting more and more concerned with. So in terms of health, we may not want those so much in our diets anymore. Every day we learn about some things that probably need to be banned or prohibited from those additives. Yeah. But beyond that, it also does destroy or change some of the taste. For example, an artificial flavoring is added because the food isn't so good. It isn't so fresh, or it's highly processed. And if we're on special diets, or just choosing to be on a certain kind of a diet, like a heart-healthy diet, or we're diabetic, or we want to feed our kids more healthy foods with low or no sugars, you can do all of this with home canning, because there's nothing in that jar but food and the food you put in it. Nothing else is added. So you have a lot of choices these days in terms of what you can can, how you can can, and what you've got in those jars. And beyond that, I got to say, it's a lot of fun. Everybody that comes to my classes over the years just loves the discovery of doing something with your hands. If you like cooking, if you like eating, it's just a great discovery. So a lot of good reasons. Now, the next question probably is going to get into about canning, and I wanted to talk a little bit about small batch canning. Do you mind if I go right into that?
No, please.
You're welcome to.
Okay. All right. Another thing about modern canning is that we don't necessarily make the large batches that our grannies did. You know, they spent all day one day putting up tomatoes and another whole day putting up 40 quarts of green beans and another day putting up corn. And it's a lot of work and it's quite intense. Today, we tend to think more in terms of the small batches either that we have from our gardens. And I know you are a gardening show, and those small batches are really nice to think about. Like, you may not have 40 quarts of beans, but you might want to do, you know, a couple of pint jars of beans, or you might want to change up the kind of ways that you make beans, maybe some beans and maybe some pickled beans and maybe some dill beans. I mean, there's just so many different ways you can do small batches and have a great array of foods in your pantry. That's more interesting to us, and it also gives us a lot more flexibility in what we pull out of our pantry to eat. So we don't have to just go to the refrigerator. We can go to the pantry and have those great things there, too. Mm-hmm. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, it does. Where would you, if you're starting this, if somebody says, this is just might be too expensive, even to do the small quantities, what would you tell them?
Well, the first thing is everybody thinks you have to have a lot of equipment. Maybe they're thinking about the pressure canner or the big, you know, blue old-time canners that are still around, by the way, and still can be bought. You don't have to. You can start out with pretty much a lot of things that you already have at home in your kitchen. So you don't have to do a lot of investment. And I frankly don't even recommend that you do until you get into it and know what you want and what you need. You can do small batch canning in any kind of pot that you have at home, like a stock pot or a clam pot or anything like that, or even a smaller a saucepan that will hold water 1 inch above your jars. So if you're tending to do smaller jars, not the big quart jars, it certainly doesn't take a big canner. And then the only other thing you really need, have to have, is the mason jars, which is recommended for home canning. They are, of course, ubiquitous right now. They're everywhere. Everybody's using them for all kinds of things, which is wonderful. I think part of that is because of the resurgence of canning. They're out there and they're getting sold, and the crafters are thinking of other ways to use them as well. But the two-piece lid on the mason jar is the secret to successful home canning. So I really recommend that, as does the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, that has given us the guidelines for home canning. You can be far more successful with those.
Those two-piece lids, it's very important that there's the top that goes directly, it's a flat piece with rubber around it, and it goes straight on the can, correct? And then there's a screw top that screws on. And
right.
Which part do they not reuse season after season?
Good question. What we call the lid, the part that actually fits on top of the jar that has the red rubber ring that makes the vacuum seal, you only want to use that once for canning, for actual canning, because that red rubber seal is fairly thin and may get corrupted in the first batch and therefore may not give you a good seal in subsequent batches. But I never recommend that you throw them out. You can recycle them for your refrigerator jars, for dry storage, for all other kinds of uses. So they're useful after that. And by the way, replacing those lids for future canning, they're very inexpensive. A little packet of a dozen usually is around $2 or $2.99, something like that. So then it's not a big investment. Once you have the jars, the jar itself is pretty indestructible. I won't say you can't crack it, but you probably won't in normal use. And the band itself that screws it on is also recyclable, and you only need to worry about it when it rusts or bends. So all of those are both those. Mm-hmm.
So it's for food safety that you need to be very aware of how to can and what lids to use and what to look for. So when you're canning or you're going into your storage room and you're looking at your masterpiece of canned goods that you've put up for the winter, what sort of things do you look for to so that you can tell whether or not the food has gone bad or rancid or you don't want to, you don't want to eat that?
There's a couple of things that I would say as a prelude to that. First of all, know how to can so that you know that you put it up successfully in the first place. In other words, if you know what the home canning guidelines are, and they're not complicated, but if you know what they are, your success in your pantry is going to be 95% or higher because you're doing it the right way. And we have those canning guidelines came out in 1989. They never had been any before that. So a lot of old-time canners are not even aware of the fact that those are out there, and they're really good to find out about. They're available online from the United States Department of Agriculture. Or another site that I want to give you guys a little later when we get to talking, that's a wonderful resource for you. But once you know that you're putting it up safely or as safely as you know how to do it, then when you're looking in the pantry, if that jar is sealed and you should be storing them without that band on, that's just the lid with that red rubber ring. It's stuck on there, and that's all that's going to be on there. You can easily tell if that lid is loose. All you do is pick it up and it's loose. If it's come loose, that's a bad jar. And we never suggest that you taste it or even worry about about it. You just throw it out immediately, no matter what it is.
Because you're going to get sick, most likely.
Okay.
What's that?
You're going to get sick, most likely, if you eat it.
You could. Some of those jars could contain botulism, which is the big scare. Mm-hmm. But some of them may just be growing a little bit of mold that might give you a tummy ache and you wouldn't even know it. But that doesn't mean you want to take that risk. So you don't, because you don't know what it is. You don't know what's growing in there. If it's had air coming in because the lid has broken that seal, then it can have any kind of bacteria that's available in your house can or your air can get into that. And
so
botulism, by the way, floats in the air. It's there. So, it's available.
Mm-hmm. So I just learned something from you, Lynn, and we're speaking with Lynn Deardorff. She's a professional canner and food preservationist from Atlanta, Georgia. You can find her classes and all kinds of great information and recipes on preservingnow.com. You just taught me something that you don't need to put the screw lid on when you're actually storing.
No, in fact, it's recommended that you take it off. You've taken it out of your water bath canner or your pressure canner, which is the two different kinds of canning we do at home, and you leave it on your counter to cool for 12 hours. And after about 1 hour, you test that lid to make sure it's sealed, which the mason jar lids are really great because you can tell by you press down on them, and if they don't give, they're sealed. If they go up and down and make a puckery sound, then they're not sealed. But once you know they're sealed, you let them continue to cool for 12 hours. Then you remove the band. And you can mark them any which way you want to, a paper label, right on the lid, whatever, the product and the date, and you put them on your pantry. There's at least two reasons why we do that. The major reason is that you can easily tell if that lid has come loose when you go to pick it up. If that band was still on there when you pulled it out of your pantry 6 months from now and you unscrewed it and that lid had come loose, you might not even realize it as you unscrewed it. You might not realize it had been loose. So that's the major health reason that you store it without the bands. The other reason is that if it starts to grow something in there and it's been in there for a while and it's growing something and it's seeping outside that jar, you're going to see that on your shelf right away as well. So you got a visual cue that something is going wrong. So it's really helpful to store without the bands. And guess what? You can be using those over and over again for your next canning project anyway. So you don't need to keep them in your pantry. I always put them back on when I give jars away, though, because they look cute and I like to put, labels on and things like that. So you want to put, and also because when you're opening that jar and putting it in your refrigerator, then you need the band. So if you're going to give it to somebody, you want to give it to them with the band so that they can store it. Yeah. Yeah.
Lynn, how long is the longest that you would put something in a pantry, and you would say that it needs to be kind of cool and dark, and it, or does it depend on the what you are preserving?
Well, that's a really tricky question. First of all, the easy answer is to tell you that if the lid is still sealed, it's mm-hmm. probably safe. And we've already talked
really?
About the fact that it's not sealed, it's not safe. We say best by date, not necessarily expired, not necessarily unsafe, but best by date is 1 year. Because all food over time will deteriorate, even in
right.
a vacuum seal. But, you know, you probably wouldn't notice the difference in taste between 1 year and 1.5 years and 2 years. If you found a jar at the back of your cabinet, and our ancestors did this all the time, oh, it's Becca, they can't so much. You know, they found something that was, you know, done 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is it still safe? Well, here's how I would judge today. First of all, is the seal still intact? And I would do a visual. How does it look? And then I would judge on whether it can grow botulism or not. And that's easy.
Mm.
High acid foods cannot grow botulism. So I would trust that okay. And that's jams and jellies, things made with fruits.
Mm-hmm.
And pickled anything that's made with a lot of, you know, vinegar to increase the acidity. Both of those mm-hmm. are high acid. And if we know we've done that ourselves and we followed credible recipes, I'd feel okay about it if the jar was still sealed. On the other hand, if it's a plain vegetable like beans or corn, not pickled, but plain, or certainly any meat product or anything else that's similar to that, then I probably wouldn't even trust it after 3 or 4 years, even if it's sealed. Just because you don't know what's happening, and because that's the deadly one. That's the one you don't want to take any chances on.
Okay.
But, you know, your granny told you she pulled that jam jar out after 3 years, and it was still fine, and she never killed anybody, and she didn't, and she wouldn't, because it's probably, first of all, fruit is high acid. All fruit is high acid. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
All fruit is high acid. Not just lemons, but all fruit, strawberries included, blueberries included.
Wow.
And she probably put a ton of sugar in it, which also acts as a preservative. So she
right.
she had a lot of good things going.
And what about brandy?
Brandy is a preservative. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Alcohol, like vinegar, is a preservative. Absolutely. You know, brandied peaches or rum-soaked cherries. I just made some rum-soaked cherries not long ago. Oh,
yum.
They're so good. And they are that's a natural preservative. And they are incredible recipes that you can do, and you can preserve those absolutely quite easily. Yeah, and really good. Have you made them? Is that how you know?
No, actually, I've never made them, but I have canned tuna and salmon, and I have to tell you, when you're canning tuna, to open all your windows. It's the most vile smell.
Does it have
ever.
To do with a fishy smell?
Yeah, and it's just a really strong stench. I can't even tell you. Like, it's kind of like, it's not like, you know, you're standing by the sea and there's this lovely, you know, whiff of fish and salt water. Oh, no, it's the worst, because you have to take the whole tuna and you put it in your oven and bake it, basically. That's how
I learned
to do it. And... Oh my goodness! The whole house reeked. I didn't have.
Right, was it
worth
it? What was the taste like after
you
canned it?
It was so worth it.
Yes.
It was beautiful. It was like, you know, better tuna than any canned tuna I've bought off the shelf.
Mm.
Oh my! See, that's so great about home canning. It always exceeds your expectations. They're so much better. Yep. Yep. I've never done meat or fish. I don't live in a part of the country that has availability of fresh fish, obviously in Georgia, in landlocked Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us are landlocked anyway. But I did do some meat in a master canning class that I took, because that was part of what we had to do. And I really had never been interested in doing that. But after seeing what they did and how easy it is to do it, and she particularly emphasized cut-up pieces of meat that you could use in things like stir-fries and stuff.
Oh.
Then I thought it really made a whole lot of sense. because it does change the texture. You probably noticed that with the tuna, too. It changes the texture. So you're not thinking of having a nice steak in a can, but you are thinking of things that you can easily use in stir fries or soups or, you know, that kind of a combination meal, or even in cold salads and stuff. So I think it's really worthwhile if you have, you know, access to a supply of meat or fish that makes it reasonable for you to buy or get. Yeah.
I just want to let our audience know that this amazing information from Lynn Deardorff, the professional canner and food preservationist from Atlanta, Georgia, preservingnow.com, is brought to you by Little Circles, littlecropcircles.com, and Little Circles, I don't know, Little Circles in the Sand, littlecropcircles.com, and they are launching September 8th. Be sure to check them out on littlecropcircles.com. Lisa, do you have any other questions? Where are we going to go from here?
Yes. We were talking earlier about seasonal canning. What information can you give folks now that we're in summer about seasonal canning?
Well, I think, Lisa, a lot of people think the only canning season is the summer. It is the height of the canning because, as we all know, there's so much that is coming into season anywhere from, probably April through September, even early October.
Yes.
In many areas of the country, maybe not all areas, but many areas. And so it's a wonderful season when we think of summer. But there really is four seasons of canning. So there's a couple of ways to look at it. First of all, don't think of that, you know, it's a stop-start time just for summer. But you can begin to get aware of the stuff that comes in later. Let me give you an example. In the fall, when you think things are kind of past, they're growing in your backyard, and that's true. They do kind of die down a little bit. And unfortunately, lettuce and greens are not one of those things we typically can, and that's about the only thing I can think of that we don't typically can at home. But everything else we do, and in the fall, you start to get into pumpkins and cranberries and apples, and pears come in a little later. Pears are wonderful in dead of winter in most places, so you have all of those kinds of things available to you, too. So what I like about seasonal canning for all of us is that if it's close by, if it's in your backyard garden, and I hope a lot of you have gardens and can do this, you've got that, but you've also got your farmers bringing it in and your farmers' markets bringing it in.
That's right.
And, of course, even your grocery stores where you're getting right now just picked really fresh, tasty food. So that's what you really want to capture when you're canning. And then you want to round it out with those things that you may not be able to get in season. Like if you really, really want to do, I'm trying to think of an example. Well, we don't grow apples down here. It's too hot. Apple trees, as you all know, come from the Northwest or the Northeast.
Yes, they do.
Sometimes up in Michigan,
Oregon.
In that area. So we can't really think of seasonal canning apples here. But I love apple butter, so obviously I buy it whenever it's coming into season somewhere else and coming into my grocery store. But I'm going to capture the season first and foremost. When those strawberries come in, it's a very short season, and I'm going to capture that so that I got them on my pantry back up in January, you know, when I just die for the taste of them, and it's amazing, you know, to have that. Or the peaches right now. I mean, we're just getting past the Vidalia onion season here, which you better believe I'm going to capture those Vidalia onions before they're gone. You know, they make a great relish. Yeah, so that's the idea is focus on.
Do you can potatoes? Can you can potatoes?
Can potatoes? You can. I haven't. It does take a pressure canner. Like all plain vegetables, it takes a pressure canner, so it's a fair amount of time, and you have to like the results. I frankly don't like the results of canned potatoes because they're going to be soft, you know. But if you have a use for them and you want to do that, like, I don't know, mashed potatoes, and you're growing a lot in your garden, yeah, you sure can. You sure can.
Okay. You know, when you were talking about apples, we live in an apple region, and our office is obviously in the middle of apple orchards and things like that. A friend of mine brought me apple pie in a jar.
Oh.
And it was so good. So she uses the apples, and then she puts in the cinnamon and nutmeg, everything that you would need. And it's very sort of gelatinous, so I think she must put some kind of something to make it sort of like a jelly, so that something like a what you would do for jams, right? Like Certo,
well,
something like that.
Pectin, you mean like a pectin? No, probably not. I'm going to guess that she's probably either adding cornstarch or flour or something like that. That's an old-time typical recipe to do that. I got to tell you that the USDA doesn't particularly recommend that. I think you can find some recipes for that. The reason is because it expands in the jar. So if she processed it, but she doesn't really have the parameters on it, she could actually have a problem, you know, with breaking the jar, or it's not going to seal, or whatever. Now maybe she's been doing it a long time and she knows what she's doing. I can't really comment on that. But you can absolutely can with all those things in the jar, except whatever is making it, thicker, whatever is
right,
making it thick. You know, my granny always put flour in it. I know other people put cornstarch in it, but whatever, whatever they've got in it. And then you simply add that when you're getting ready to make your pie, because you can just spoon that in. So you don't really have to put it in there, and you can absolutely make apple pie filling in a jar without putting any thickener in it. Thickener is a little bit of a problem. It's one of the no-nos, and it's one of the reasons they tell you you can can dry beans, but you need to reconstitute them ahead of time for the same reason. They're going to really expand, and you want to make sure that they don't expand beyond the capability of the jar, you know. But you can do it.
You know, it's something I learned how to do on the farm is skin tomatoes and skin peaches, things like that. Can you quickly tell the audience how you can get the skin off some of these vegetables where they might not want the skin?
Well, okay, I got you. You've really opened a big question for me. it's really a good one. It's really an interesting thing that I'll give you some insight in my classes. First of all, you can get the skin off of tomatoes, which I do take off. I can a lot of tomatoes. It's one of the things that we use. Almost all of us use a lot of tomatoes over the year in our cooking. And now that I've been canning tomatoes for years, I will never buy them at the store again because they're so amazing. But you do want to take the skins off. Or when you water bath them, they will separate and come off the tomatoes anyway. And you don't want them floating around in your tomatoes. So, yes, you do want that. I'll come back to fruit and peaches in a minute. Blanching is always the best and easiest way to do it. Some people do it over a flame. Some people roast them. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just whatever your preference is. But blanching to me is easier. And what you do is you take the core out of the top. You don't, as far as I'm concerned, you do not need to remove the seeds. Some people do, but I think that's a waste of time, and I think they add flavor. And then you make a little X in the bottom. That just helps the skin to come off. And you put it into boiling water up to about a minute or less. It depends on the thickness of the skins, and all the tomatoes will vary. And as soon as you're just starting to see it crinkle or peel, you pull it out and plunge it into ice water that you have ready, and that skin will just slip right off. And it's very fast, and you can do bunches of it in a hurry. That's my go-to method.
Cool. I know you have some resources to share with people. We have just over a minute to.
Okay. Well, the major one that I really want to tell you all about is the National Center for Home Food Preservation. It is a godsend. It was created as a result of the United States Department of Agriculture working at UGA, University of Georgia, when they did all their testing in 89 and 90. And that center is an amazing resource for recipes, answers questions. It has just so much there that you can't exhaust, and definitive answers that meet the guidelines. And they also have what I consider the Bible of home canning, the book for any beginner home canner, any advanced canner, called So Easy to Preserve. And you can order it through that website. It's about $18 for the 6th edition. It is amazing, and it gives you even more than canning. It gives you drying and freezing and so forth. So it's a basic cookbook to have, and it answers a lot of questions that you'll always come up with, along with the safe guidelines.
And that's the National Organization of?
National Center for Home Food Preservation. And this is the website, NCHFP, it's the initials, obviously, nchfp.uga.edu. That
I want to
is
say
something.
Quickly, thank you very much, Lynn Deardorff.
You are
preservingnow.com.
So
And make sure you go to our website, preservingnow.com. Littlecropcircles.com is our sponsor. And always check us out, thegardeningnetwork.com. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great day.